I have an app and I make $15 a year from Amazon affiliate. Yay!
Whoa! You don't have to show off with your filthy richness, you know, from Amazon, you know. In our hospital, out of 100 patients, 99 patients, you know, survived this operation. Mm-hmm. Up until now, we had 99 successes. So next patient is going to die.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and then we wouldn't have hired you because we only hired child prodigies, nothing else. So
shut up. Hello, I'm Radek.
I'm Michael.
And this is the podcast.
A sounding board for interesting ideas and insights. We discuss books we read and want to share with you.
As well as technology and productivity, which is what we do by day working on our app, Nozbe.
Or whatever else comes to mind.
So we're back from the trip, or you are still in the same city.
Yeah.
And we're going back to...
moved an inch.
Yeah. Yeah, my whole trip back was like 20 minutes.
Like you, I had a flight to catch.
Yeah, on foot.
Yeah.
So we're back to discussing books.
Yeah, another book, a random book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found it quite randomly, and then I read it. I thought it's kind of interesting, and I recommended it to you.
Well, I read his, Nassim Taleb's previous book, The Black Swan, mm-hmm. but I don't remember much of it, actually. I remember The Black Swan theory and what it's all about. But with this book, I'm still finishing it. I have, I think, 40 minutes to go or something like that, mm-hmm. so I'm almost at the end. I don't know. The book is kind of random, you know. It's like I don't like the way the book is structured and the way the book works. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure about, you know, what the author really wants to tell us. I can try to summarize, but there are a few ideas that I really like, but the rest I'm just a little bit confused. So I hope that you will help me out here with understanding.
So you're saying you're skeptical?
Yeah.
So basically you're becoming like me.
Yeah, so in this version, like I am you and you are me. So you are the enthusiast and I am the skeptical now. So we switch places now.
Okay. all right. So I think I have a pretty decent grip on what the book is about. But since you are confused, maybe you try to explain it in a few words, like what it's about, what its central thesis is.
Okay. So from my point of view, the author is trying to say is that we are trying too hard to make sense of the world. Like we mm-hmm. are trying too hard to make sense, like for the things to make sense, where in most cases, things are random. So like there is lots of luck involved and there's lots of randomness involved. And as you said, very often on this show, hindsight is 2020. Like, so we are trying in the hindsight to figure out why something happened. Mm-hmm. To make sense of the world again. But very often this explanation doesn't make any sense because it was totally random. I think the author is trying to convince us that, you know, that we should, I don't know, look at the world with more randomized glasses. So to not try to make sense so much, not to focus on that, but just, you know, take things as they are and just accept random situations.
That makes sense. I think one other thing he was trying to say is that even when we do see that there's a lot of randomness involved in whatever we're looking at, we're just not well equipped to deal with it. Like our minds are not really wired to understand the nature of randomness. We're wired to see things as deterministic, and they don't always are. Or, you know, maybe they are, but abstracted so much that they might as well be random. And we don't naturally interpret randomness correctly. And even if we are consciously aware of the nature of randomness, still our minds, our emotions fool us and cause us to, interpret random events incorrectly and assign meaning to where there is none.
Okay, but because by reading this book, you can come up with this thing, with this notion that, you know, whatever I do doesn't matter. It's all random, you know? Mm-hmm. And, well, and this would be like, a dangerous extreme anyway, you know? Because, like, it's like, you know, there's this saying that luck comes to the prepared, you know? So mm-hmm. if somebody is more prepared, then, and they're lucky, then, you know, they're more likely to succeed than somebody who's not prepared and they turn out to be lucky and then they fail anyway. So
okay, yeah, that makes sense to me.
So you know, so it's, you know, it's again, I'm confused because after reading this book, I'm like, okay, so should I attribute everything to luck or mm-hmm. just some of it, you know, or maybe more than I would hope to think, and how like, you know.
You do seem confused.
Yeah.
I think context helps. Nassim Taleb is a trader. So, you know, he makes money on trading derivatives. And so this is a kind of field where there is a high degree of randomness. And the reason why he survived in that environment for far longer than others is because he understands the nature of randomness better. So one example that he would show over and over, which does confirm your theory that, you know, luck comes to the prepared, that in his field, traders are judged not by tenure but by profit. And the weird nature of randomness in the markets is such that you can make a lot more profit by doing things that work most of the time, but then every 10 years there's this extreme event, this black swan event, as he would say, which will, you know, wipe out all those positions and those traders which were, you know, most amazing, most profitable, and people would assign, you know, all sorts of virtue and skill to their profits. And in reality, they just follow the strategy, which eventually would blow up and they would lose more money than they ever made. Whereas he would make steady money over time and in fact make most money on those black swan events. And so most of the time, you know, he would be prepared, you know, because he understands the nature of randomness better. So he would stay in this longer and he wouldn't care about the fact that, you know, others are fooled by the numbers now. Others see, okay, this guy is the most profitable, so he's the best, he's the most skilled. When in reality, it's just randomness, right? It's just the fact that he's playing a game which almost inevitably will blow up.
Yeah, there was a story of two different traders that were in quite the beginning of the book, where mm-hmm. one of them was like the steady trader. He had, you know, the skill set, and he was like making safe bets, and he had like a structure of how he was investing money and how he was getting the money, and he mm-hmm. was earning pretty good money, really good money. But then he had his neighbor who was far more successful, he was, I really like that. He was asking himself, maybe he's playing too safe. You know, maybe he should, you know, change the way he's playing, because apparently the other guy is not playing safe and he's, you know, earning a lot more. Mm-hmm. So I like the story on two different levels. So first level was, you know, the premise of the book, that the other guy was fooled by randomness. He attributed his enormous success to his skill, whereas it wasn't his skill, it was his stroke of luck, you know, in that moment. So mm-hmm. he was lucky in many ways, and then when his luck turned, he went broke. So that's, you know, that's the thing. So I think the first lesson here is to you know, stay humble and, you know, not, you know, bet everything on one thing, and, you know, and not attribute everything to yourself and to your own skills and to, you mm-hmm. know, to eat your own bullshit, you know, to, you know, to, in a way that, you know, that you think that you're the best because, you know, you think so, you know, ego and stuff. Ego is the enemy. We talked about it before on this show. So I would say this thing was also good. But the other thing that I also found in this story, and I found it really fascinating and really something it struck home, was the fact that, you know, we are pretty successful with Nosby, you know, we are 10 years in business, we are profitable, we have a growing team, we have a growing user base, we are changing the world of people who are using our tool and stuff. But it's a steady climb. It's not like we are right now, you know, disrupting everything, and we have millions of paying users, and we have billions of dollars. I am not on Forbes, whatever list. Who cares about that? Mm-hmm. So when you read all these, you know, all these things about these guys, these immense successes, you start thinking, mm-hmm. maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe I'm playing too safe. Maybe I should, you know, disrupt the whole thing. Maybe I should get investor right now and, I don't know, get a billion or die trying, right? I mean, you know, this kind of thing. And it's really tempting to think like that, you know? And it's really tempting to think that, you know, if you do something differently, you will get that, you know? That maybe you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation, an emotional state that I sometimes feel myself in. And I really have to struggle with this to, you know, put myself back to earth and say, you know, Michael, you're doing a good job. Yes, you have things to improve, and so keep improving. But what you're doing is the right way to go. It's really hard to think like that.
Yeah, I agree. That's the nature of the being fooled part, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are successful, but our emotions still fool us because we naturally end up comparing ourselves to these wild successes, which are partly attributed perhaps to the skills, but were largely lucky. They were in the right place at the right time. You know, Mark Zuckerberg started by making a simple website in PHP. Anyone could do that, right? And he's smart. He's really smart. But you know, all those successes, they're lucky. They're lucky too. And it makes no sense to compare ourselves to them, because we're only seeing the successes.
Yeah.
All the people and companies that try to shoot for the stars and just burn up, we don't see them. That's one of those biases that the book talked about, one of the most common ones, the survivorship bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
You judge from the data you see, and you only see success. Failure is filtered out. So you don't see how likely the success would be in reality if you follow that path. Whereas this path, it's still successful. It's still good. And, you know, it's pretty solid. It's not just going to break down tomorrow.
Yeah. And also for me, I don't know if it was meant to be like from this book, but because when I was reading this book and he was talking about like dramatic failures and dramatic, you know, situations where people would lose everything,
mm-hmm.
through to, because they didn't understand the randomness part. So it's also the idea that we should really, you know, diversify, you know, if we and save and then like do these boring things, like this boring, you know, trader, like do these boring things to be able. So we don't find ourselves in this moment where we can bet everything on one thing and then it just blows up. You know, mm-hmm. that we should really, whenever we, you know, invest or, you know, put our money or, you know, do things, we should do them, you know, we should not depend on our brilliance, but focus on like be more humble and just, you know, like do smaller steps, you know, do like, you know, I don't know, more humble steps and more humble investments, you know, things like that, that when you do blow up from some business venture or some business idea, you're still fine. You know, you're still okay.
Mm-hmm. That's in contrast to the essentialist philosophy, which mm-hmm. we also talked about. So I suppose those are like these two very different mental models, which I think are both very relevant, but perhaps in different situations.
Mm-hmm.
Like essentialism is about focus. It's about optimizing for, you know, our flaws as human beings, that we can't do everything, and we get easily distracted if we try to do 100 things. And the diversification thing makes sense in other contexts, like when investing money on capital markets, for example. Like that's, you know, would it be very smart to bet on one thing due to the nature of randomness?
Yeah, but you know, it depends. Like for example, for me, this as you said, these things actually they work together a little bit because you know, for me, the essential part is Nosby, right? So I should focus everything I do on moving our project forward, and this I am betting on one horse, like on this Nosby thing. But because meanwhile it is earning money, and I get some money from it right now. I'm not betting it right now to earn money in 5 years from Nosby. I'm getting a salary now. So with the salary, I'm trying to diversify, you know, to invest and to have, you know, the means and not just, you know, eat it up, you know, and live from the first to the first. But I'm diversifying in this, you know, in my money that I earn from Nosby. But on the other hand, my whole work is focused on Nosby. So this is how I see it.
Coming back to the book as a whole, you said that you didn't really like its structure. And I have to agree. To me, the book was rambly, I guess.
Yeah, right?
I mean, it was very enjoyable, actually, to listen to, because it was a fun story, right? It was structured as this kind of amorphous story. But then I sat down to compile my notes from like little snippets, and I found it hard because it was a fun read, and there was, I think, a lot of wisdom in it, but it doesn't have a structure.
No, and like coming back to essentialism, which I just read on paper after I've listened to it twice, it had a lot better structure. Like, yes. So it made total sense how it was structured. For example, there were a few chapters in this book in The Fooled by Randomness that like you would like almost get to a point and then the chapter would end. And I'm like, so what happened here? Like, you know, he would just lose me, you know? It was like, there was a pause even. So there was like, you know, in the audio version, there was no music or anything. So it was like a big pause. And I was like, is it broken or does it work? I mean, is it playing? Oh yeah, it is. Chapter, next one. Huh. So yeah. So that, but the technicality. But anyway. Yeah. The point. maybe it was the point of the book to be more random than it should be.
maybe.
I don't know. But coming back to, you know, to this, you know, Fooled by Randomness is the. From my understanding, this is the thing. You know, it's more like a cautionary tale, that.
Yes.
We should attribute a little bit more to random facts than we think. You know, whatever happens to us, whatever happens to other people, you know, we should be mindful that, you know, there is this luck, this randomness happening, and that we're not equipped to understand it. So we understand how things work. So we should just, you know, let it go.
Mm-hmm. I think the book really fit our philosophy in a way, or at least my philosophy. One of the premises of the book is that we humans are flawed, not just imperfect, but fundamentally flawed, right? We're irrational, we're emotional, and we don't need moralizing lectures. We need tricks and mind hacks, right? We can't. A very, you know, a rational mind can't do much to influence our emotions directly. It's far better to understand our limitations and rationally create an environment in which our emotions are less likely to fool us into making stupid decisions. And I think that's partly what the book was about. It gave a lot of examples. Not just, you know, moralizing lectures on how randomness works, but how we're fooled by it and how to, you know, create a life for yourself in which you're less likely to be fooled. Like, for example, many of these stories were very much in the context of the author being a trader, but he talked about reading news, for example, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, it's a waste of time. You're just seeding yourself with noise, and it creates a lot of emotions, and it doesn't matter. It's mostly noise, and it's better to look at the data, look at how your positions are doing less often, not more often. We're tempted to do more often because that's technology, right? We can do real time and everything. But actually, because of our flaws, we should do less often, because the nature of randomness is such that time smooths out noise. Over time, you see more and more signal, and noise becomes a smaller part, right? And so, like, if you kind of try to cut yourself out from some of the noise, you end up making better decisions, even though you have less information, because more of the information you get is actual signal and not noise.
Yeah. Well, that just reinforces my idea of, you know, of not really watching news and things like that. I mean, I read somewhere that news is like sweets, you know, like a small, you know, sweets, and then you just eat them, and then they're fine, and they're sweet, and they make you feel, you know, I don't know, informed. Good. Or, you know, feel that you know so much stuff, but you don't, because these are all superficial, you know, things, and they are very often, as the author pointed out, not really true things. I mean, the journalists try to make headline of anything, you know, out of thin air. You know, there's nothing happening, but they would say, you know, something happened, and you would believe that this actually happened, or that the probability was like that. And in the end, it's not true, you know. But it defines how you decide things, you know.
The phrase I've heard for news is intellectual empty calories.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah, it doesn't mean you shouldn't, you know, stay more or less up to date with what's happening, but you can do it, you know, after your weekly review, actually, to read a few, like, interesting articles in a few magazines, but read them well, and not just read a few headlines, you know?
Yeah, and the important things filter out to you anyway. Like, again, that's the thing. At times moves out noise.
Yeah.
Another example which I really liked, it's not a surprising one, I've heard a version of that before, but it goes like this. Say you become very successful, maybe you start an internet company, maybe you make, you know, maybe you're the top 1% or whatever, right? And then you feel like, oh, I'm successful. So you move into the richest neighborhood in the city.
Right.
And then in that neighborhood, you're the least wealthy of all the families living there. And nothing changed. You're still as successful as you have been. But now, you feel like shit. You feel worthless. You feel like the worst. Because, not because of anything in reality, but because you're fooled by, not by randomness perhaps, but by the information you see. Your emotional brain is incapable of processing the fact that you're still top 1%, you naturally contrast yourself to the top 1% of the top 1%, and among them you're the worst, and you feel like failure, right? And so the kind of fooled by randomness solution to this is to accept your irrationality as a human being, not try to be like, oh, I understand it, because it's not enough that you understand it rationally, but you just you just don't move into the super rich neighborhood in the first place, right?
Yeah.
And there's you can make up plenty of more mundane examples of this, where you interpret data because of availability bias, because of survivorship bias. You make decisions, or your mind plays tricks on you and makes you feel bad because of the information that's in front of you, even though that's not the full information.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I mean, and this is what I said also previously, that when I compare myself to other, you know, CEOs of other companies, I can either decide I'm very successful, or I can decide or I can think I'm a complete you know, failure. Yeah. I'm not worth billions. I'm not on the stock exchange or whatever. You know, I'm like, you know, whatever. I can make up things. But it's a good, yeah, it's yeah, that was a good thing. I mean, he was trying to tell us that the sample is important. Like if you, as you said, if your sample, if you compare yourself to the richest people on the planet, you will become a failure, you know, in your own eyes, because it's not the whole sample. It's just a sample of the richest people, and it's the same thing with everything that we compare to, you know, wherever you know, analyze data. The same goes with successes and failures and everything else. And yeah, it's a good idea not to move up to the richest neighborhoods. It's like whenever I visit London, I'm like, these guys have to earn lots of money there, lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have to spend so much on the housing and on everything else there and on these fancy cars and whatever. I'm like, whoa.
Cars in London? What planet are you on?
What do you mean?
Who has a car in central London?
The ones who show off, they're all all the best cars are in London.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fine.
I mean, that's true. It's amazing. Like, you know, I don't know why would they, you know, buy these cars, because you can hardly move there. You know,
it makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Like you have a 600 horsepower car that, you know, goes 20 kilometers per hour. So, way to go. But what I'm saying is that, you know, they like the level, like it's the same with San Francisco, you know, you have to spend so much money to live there. And, you know, you could be a more successful, you know, I don't know, developer or whoever, or entrepreneur, if you would live in a different place, and you wouldn't have that costs, and then you could just focus on just creating value and earning money and having a good life, you know. And it's crazy what people are, what we do, you know. And
I just recently talked to a friend who lives in San Francisco, and he was like, you know, he earns a lot more money than I do, but he has no savings. Like, how do you have savings in San Francisco? I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah,
right.
Crazy stuff. No, it's really crazy stuff. Yeah. No. So the sample matters, and compare, and also this thing that, you know, we tend to compare each other, you know, to other people, and it's in our human nature, and that's why I think we are being fooled by this, because as you said, we tend to compare because this is how we roll, this is how we think, but then we don't realize we pick up wrong samples, and then we make wrong comparisons, and we get wrong conclusions from that.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I found really interesting, this thought experiment in the book, it's about kind of the limitations of empiricism, you know, inductive reasoning. It's like, say you inspect 5,000 swans, right?
Yeah.
And you see that all are white. So you conclude that all swans are white. But you can never conclude that with 100% certainty, right? Unless you know for a fact that you've inspected all swans that exist. But the other way around is completely different. Like it takes just one black swan to falsify the statement that all swans are white.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So, like, in a way, you can only falsify statements empirically, but you can never really prove them. So that's a big problem when we're making decisions based on data, because you know, we try to be smarter and use data and collect data and make decisions based on data, but the world is changing from underneath us. So we see that X has always been true, and so we conclude that X always must be true, not from first principles, but through inductive reasoning. It's, you know, all the samples we have says that X is true, so it must be true. But maybe it's not. And like the whole history of technology and internet technology and disruption and whatever is all about breaking those assumptions, right? Or the other way around. For example, you're investing on the markets and you decide X never happened before, so it's a safe bet that it won't happen. but it's not. Like, just because all the samples you have says X never happened doesn't mean it cannot happen. You know what I'm saying? So this is stupid, but it's not. Like, we can so easily be fooled by thinking that just because we have some data or more data, we've collected more samples, that this is enough to discern the truth. And it just... That's not always the case, right? Because the samples we've been taking will have all sorts of other assumptions that are implicit, right? And then the world changes, or something else we do changes, and the assumptions break, and we feel more confident in making, you know, bold decisions because data. But in reality, we're even fooled than, you know, we're even more fooled than we would be if we had none.
Yeah. I really like, there was an example of this, you know, in our hospital, out of 100 patients, 99 patients, you know, survived this operation. Mm-hmm. Up until now, we had 99 successes. So next patient is going to die.
Okay. Yeah. That's another thing. But yeah, that's also an example of being fooled by statistics, like, if you don't understand it, right?
Yeah.
I really like this idea for a con.
Uh-huh.
Okay? You send 10,000 letters to people predicting a market movement.
Oh, yeah, right.
You tell half the people that this will go up and the other half that it will go down. And you repeat next month. You will be right in one of those samples. So to the 5,000 people next month, half of them you say it will go up and half of them you say it will go down.
Yeah.
And after 5 months, you know, 300 people will get letters predicting market movements correctly 5 months in a row.
Yeah.
And you've proved your market brilliance. This cannot be a coincidence. You've caught it 5 months in a row. You must be insider. Yeah. And you ask them to give your money. But that, just because, you know, it's such a clever use of the fact that the people you're fooling don't know the sample size.
This is crazy, right?
Yeah. Or when you said the thing about the 99th person.
Yeah.
It's like, I was really laughing at the life expectancy thing, right? So mm-hmm. Life expectancy is 80 years and you're 65. So you should plan to be alive for 15 more years. Well, what if you're 90? Should you expect to be dead for 10 years? And that makes no sense, right?
Yeah, what's your life expectancy? Minus 10?
yeah, that's your life expectancy. I mean, it makes no sense. Like, I think in the past we talked, or at least we both read the book Naked Statistics, and it talked a lot about things like that. Just simple, you know, matters of statistics and how to calculate stuff like that. And this is really annoying in media, especially like media covering science and technology, and they're throwing around numbers and percentages and statistics, and it makes them sound smart. Yeah. But then some of the time, you know better about a thing, and you just see that they're making, you know, stupid mistakes like this, you know, like with life expectancy. Like, that's the life expectancy at birth. If you're 65, your conditional life expectancy is longer because you're still alive, right? And that's one of the many annoying things about coming back to reading the news, that you know, journalists so often just don't understand statistics and don't understand science and have no real idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about conditional probabilities was pretty interesting, that, you know, that there are these conditions that, you know, we have to take under consideration. If we don't, then the data is just crazy stupid. It's like, doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, coming back to again, to this notion of success and things, and I couldn't help by analyzing, you know, things, you know, retrospectively, you know, what happened to me, how I started, you know, with the business and things, and trying to figure out how much I can attribute to, you know, to luck, you know, mm-hmm. and randomness. And Yeah, it's crazy stuff. I mean, just coming back to how we met, you know, if you think about it, you know,
Oh, yeah.
it's totally crazy, you know. Should
I tell the story?
Yeah, you should.
Okay, so we met because I made this app called Tadam, which is a simple app for the Mac. And I mean, still in the store. And I knew you from the internet, and I knew you used the Mac, and that you blog about productivity. And so I thought, okay, maybe I'll just email you and pitch you the app, and if you like it, maybe you'll write about it, and I'll get some more sales, right? And you did write about it, and it didn't change a thing, but it so happened that you needed help with some thing on the Mac. And so the crazy thing is that if I didn't make this app, oh, we wouldn't met. If you didn't need help at that moment, perhaps I'd never hear from you again. And why did I know about you in the first place? Well, I knew about you because I knew about the company 37 Signals, which is our competitor, funny enough. And on their blog, Signal versus Noise, at one point you were in their office and you recorded an interview with Jason Fried, their CEO. And Jason Fried posted a link to your magazine, Private Magazine, to the interview. And it so happened, and I noticed it because I was reading them. And it so happened that I was going on vacation and I would just spend the next week just doing nothing, just chilling on the beach. So I literally printed on paper, that was before I had an iPad, a bunch of issues of the Private Magazine, because I was just at this point where I was interested in it because I felt like I needed help with my productivity. And I did. It was interesting, right? And I knew about 37 Signals because I read their book, Rework. And I have no idea how I came across this book. So if I didn't came across this book, or if I didn't start reading them, or if I wasn't interested in reading Productive Magazine at that point in my life, or if you didn't fly to Chicago to record the interview, or if you didn't make the Productive Magazine at all, or if you didn't need help with the Mac thing, or if I never emailed you, or if I never made this app, which I did partly because Rework kind of showed me that, oh, you know, I can make a little thing and maybe it works. If any of those things didn't happen, then we'd probably never meet.
Yeah, but there's additional spin to it. Actually, before Nosby, I was a contractor. I was doing websites, and you later found out that you were also working on a website of the same customer later after me, and you found in the code of the website actually my name. So you could have met me with that as well. Like there are so many, like if like when you think about the story, there are so many, you know, ways it could have gone differently. It's crazy. Like it's really crazy, you know? And so whenever I think about this story, it's for me the great example of how many, as you said, as you just, you know, listed, how many small decisions and small things led to this.
Yeah, and completely random, completely unpredictable. You know, in hindsight, it makes this pretty story. But you know, at that point, like I could never have predicted the sequence of events that would lead us to where we are now, right? And you know, I could have been in a very different place if I didn't meet you, and if this wasn't my first job out of school, but some other job, which, you know, I mean, who knows, right? And I did things which influenced the fact that I got here. The prepared are those that get lucky, right? But still, so much random and so many things I could never have controlled.
Yeah, it brings me back to the story of how Nosby started, you know, when I launched it. And okay, I did some work, like promotional work. I was a part of different GTD communities, you know, before I launched Nosby. So I did some stuff, but you know, but all of a sudden there was this, you know, one of the bloggers I was following, he wrote an article on Nozbe on this big, you know, website, and then from there, like, all the links came up and then everything. So again, it was luck. I was kind of prepared, but it's hard to attribute everything to my, you know, preparedness or, you know, hard work. It's always, you know, this, like, there's this randomness fact, and there is no recipe for that. I can, you know, you can ask me about the secret of my success, and I will tell you all these pretty stories like the one that we have. But, you know, we're trying to, you know, make sense of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Or another one, you probably heard this story, but I don't think I ever told on the show. I have an elder brother. He's 8 years older. And at the time when, you know, when he was in high school, and in high school, he had just basics of programming, like HTML, stuff like that, really, right? I was 8 years younger, and we shared a computer, right? And because he was doing these things at school, he had this app on our shared computer for making websites. It was a WYSIWYG editor, right? And I discovered that. And I kind of got, you know, interested in it because I could do stuff, you know, I could make a computer do things. Mm-hmm. And then it had attached like tutorials for HTML and CSS and PHP. And that's how I started with programming. Mm-hmm. And I was 11, and it was pure luck, right? It was just, again, more sequence of events that are completely random, right? The fact that I have an older brother, that he had this at school, that he installed this app, that we had a shared computer, that I discovered it and got interested in it and probably had too much time, bored to explore this thing. I, you know, it would be so simple for me to never see that, and maybe I wouldn't be a programmer then, or I would discover it many years later. It's just luck. It's just luck.
Yeah, and then we wouldn't have hired you, because we only hired child prodigies, nothing else. So
shut up.